The United States was out in the world now in a way it had never been. The stakes were large. World supremacy. And, as Truman's committee said, our smallest actions have far-reaching effects. And so the United States went ahead to take small actions, hoping they would have large effects. Congress did not move to enact the legislation asked for by the Committee on Civil Rights. But Truman, 4 months before the presidential election of 1948, and challenged from the left in that election by Progressive Party candidate Henry Wallace, issued an executive order asking that the armed forces, segregated in World War II, institute policies of racial equality as rapidly as possible. The order may have been prompted not only by the election, but by the need to maintain black morale in the armed forces as the possibility of war grew. It took over a decade to complete the desegregation in the military. Truman could have issued executive orders in other areas, but did not. The 14th and 15th Amendments, plus the set of laws passed in the late 1860s and early 1870s, gave the president enough authority to wipe out racial discrimination. The Constitution demanded that the president execute the laws, but no president had used that power. Neither did Truman. For instance, he asked Congress for legislation prohibiting discrimination in interstate transportation facilities, but specific legislation in 1887 already barred discrimination in interstate transportation and had never been enforced by executive action. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court was taking steps, 90 years after the Constitution had been amended to establish racial equality, to move toward that end. During the war, it ruled that the white primary used to exclude blacks from voting in the Democratic Party primaries, which in the South were really the elections, was unconstitutional. In 1954, the court finally struck down the separate but equal doctrine that it had defended since the 1890s. The NAACP brought a series of cases before the court to challenge segregation in the public schools, and now in Brown versus the Board of Education, the court said the separation of school children generates a feeling of inferiority that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. In the field of public education, it said, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. The court did not insist on immediate change. A year later, it said that segregated facilities should be integrated with all deliberate speed. By 1965, 10 years after the all deliberate speed guideline, more than 75% of the school districts in the South remained segregated. Still, it was a dramatic decision, and the message went around the world in 1954 that the American government had outlawed segregation. In the United States, too, for those not thinking about the customary gap between word and fact, it was an exhilarating sign of change. What to others seemed rapid progress, to blacks, was apparently not enough. In the early 1960s, black people rose in rebellion all over the South, and in the late 1960s, they were engaging in wild insurrection in 100 northern cities. It was all a surprise to those without that deep memory of slavery, that everyday presence of humiliation, registered in the poetry, the music, the occasional outbursts of anger, the more frequent sullen silences. Part of that memory was of words uttered, laws passed, decisions made, which turned out to be meaningless. For such a people, with such a memory, and such daily recapitulation of history, revolt was always minutes away, in a timing mechanism which no one had set, but which might go off with some unpredictable set of events. Those events came at the end of 1955, in the capital city of Alabama, Montgomery. 3 months after her arrest, Mrs. Rosa Parks, a 43-year-old seamstress, explained why she refused to obey the Montgomery law providing for segregation on city buses, why she decided to sit down in the white section of the bus. Well, in the first place, I had been working all day on the job. I was quite tired after spending a full day working. I handle and work on clothing that white people wear. That didn't come in my mind, but this is what I wanted to know. When and how would we ever determine our rights as human beings? It just happened that the driver made a demand, and I just didn't feel like obeying his demand. He called a policeman, and I was arrested and placed in jail. Montgomery blacks called a mass meeting. They voted to boycott all city buses. Carpools were organized to take Negroes to work. Most people walked. The city retaliated by indicting 100 leaders of the boycott and sent many to jail. White segregationists turned to violence. Bombs exploded in 4 Negro churches. A shotgun blast was fired through the front door of the home of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the 27-year-old Atlanta-born minister who was one of the leaders of the boycott. King's home was bombed, but the black people of Montgomery persisted, and in November 1956, the Supreme Court outlawed segregation on local bus lines. Montgomery was the beginning. It forecast the style and mood of the vast protest movement that would sweep the South in the next 10 years. Emotional church meetings, Christian hymns adapted to current battles, references to lost American ideals, the commitment to nonviolence, the willingness to struggle and sacrifice. A New York Times reporter described a mass meeting in Montgomery during the boycott. "One after the other, indicted Negro leaders took the rostrum in a crowded Baptist church tonight to urge their followers to shun the city's buses and walk with God. More than 2,000 Negroes filled the church from basement to balcony and overflowed into the street. They chanted and sang. They shouted and prayed. They collapsed in the aisles and they sweltered in an 85-degree heat. They pledged themselves again and again to passive resistance. Under this banner, they have carried on for 80 days a stubborn boycott of the city's buses." Martin Luther King at that meeting gave a preview of the oratory that would soon inspire millions of people to demand racial justice. He said the protest was not merely over buses, but over things that go deep down into the archives of history. He said, "We have known humiliation. We have known abusive language. We have been plunged into the abyss of oppression. And we decided to raise up only with the weapon of protest. It is one of the greatest glories of America that we have the right of protest. If we are arrested every day, if we are exploited every day, if we are trampled over every day, don't ever let anyone pull you so low as to hate them. We must use the weapon of love. We must have compassion and understanding for those who hate us. We must realize so many people are taught to hate us that they are not totally responsible for their hate. But we stand in life at midnight. We are always on the threshold of a new dawn." King's stress on love and nonviolence was powerfully effective in building a sympathetic following throughout the nation, among whites as well as blacks. But there were blacks who thought the message naive, that while there were misguided people who might be won over by love, there were others who would have to be bitterly fought, and not always with nonviolence. 2 years after the Montgomery boycott in Monroe, North Carolina, an ex-Marine named Robert Williams, the president of the local NAACP, became known for his view that blacks should defend themselves against violence, with guns if necessary. When local Klansmen attacked the home of one of the leaders of the Monroe NAACP, Williams and other blacks, armed with rifles, fired back. The Klan left. The Klan was being challenged now with its own tactic of violence. A Klan raid on an Indian community in North Carolina was repelled by Indians firing rifles. Still, in the years that followed, Southern blacks stressed nonviolence. On February 1, 1960, 4 freshmen at a Negro college in Greensboro, North Carolina, decided to sit down at the Woolworth's lunch counter downtown, where only whites ate. They were refused service, and when they would not leave, the lunch counter was closed for the day. The next day they returned, and then, day after day, other Negroes came to sit silently. In the next 2 weeks, sit-ins spread to 15 cities in 5 southern states. A 17-year-old sophomore at Spelman College in Atlanta, Ruby Doris Smith, heard about Greensboro. "When the student committee was formed, I told my older sister to put me on the list. And when 200 students were selected for the first demonstration, I was among them. I went through the food line in the restaurant at the state capitol with 6 other students, but when we got to the cashier, she wouldn't take our money. The lieutenant governor came down and told us to leave. We didn't and went to the county jail. In his Harlem apartment in New York, a young Negro teacher of mathematics named Bob Moses saw a photo in the newspapers of the Greensboro sit-inners. The students in that picture had a certain look on their faces, sort of sullen, angry, determined. Before, the Negro in the South had always looked on the defensive, cringing. This time they were taking the initiative. They were kids my age, and I knew this had something to do with my own life. There was violence against the sit-inner, but the idea of taking the initiative against segregation took hold. In the next 12 months, more than 50,000 people, mostly black, some white, participated in demonstrations of one kind or another in 100 cities, and over 3,600 people were put in jail. But by the end of 1960, lunch counters were open to blacks in Greensboro and many other places. A year after the Greensboro incident, a northern-based group dedicated to racial equality, CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, organized freedom rides in which blacks and whites traveled together on buses going through the South to try to break the segregation pattern in interstate travel. Such segregation had long been illegal, but the federal government never enforced the law in the South. The president now was John F. Kennedy, but he too seemed cautious about the race question, concerned about the support of Southern white leaders of the Democratic Party. The two buses that left Washington, D.C. on May 4, 1961, headed for New Orleans, never got there. In South Carolina, riders were beaten. In Alabama, a bus was set afire. Freedom riders were attacked with fists and iron bars. The Southern police did not interfere with any of this violence, nor did the federal government. FBI agents watched, took notes, did nothing. At this point, veterans of the sit-ins, who had recently formed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, dedicated to nonviolent but militant action for equal rights, organized another freedom ride from Nashville to Birmingham. Before they started out, they called the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., to ask for protection. As Ruby Doris Smith reported, the Justice Department said no, they couldn't protect anyone, but if something happened, they would investigate. You know how they do. The racially mixed SNCC Freedom Riders were arrested in Birmingham, Alabama, spent a night in jail, were taken to the Tennessee border by police, made their way back to Birmingham, took a bus to Montgomery, and there were attacked by whites with fists and clubs in a bloody scene. They resumed their trip to Jackson, Mississippi. By this time, the Freedom Riders were in the news all over the world, and the government was anxious to prevent further violence. Attorney General Robert Kennedy, instead of insisting on their right to travel without being arrested, agreed to the Freedom Riders being arrested in Jackson in return for Mississippi police protection against possible mob violence. As Victor Navasky comments in Kennedy Justice about Robert Kennedy, he didn't hesitate to trade the Freedom Riders' constitutional right to interstate travel for Senator Eastland's guarantee of their right to live. The Freedom Riders did not become subdued in jail. They resisted, protested, sang, demanded their rights. Stokely Carmichael recalled later how he and his fellow inmates were singing in the Parchman Jail in Mississippi, and the sheriff threatened to take away their mattresses. I hung on to the mattress and said, I think we have a right to them, and I think you're unjust. And he said, I don't want to hear all that shit, nigger, and started to put on the wrist breakers. I wouldn't move and started to sing, I'm going to tell God how you treat me. And everybody started to sing it. And by this time, Tyson was really to pieces. He called to the trustees, get him in there. And he went out the door and slammed it and left everybody else with their mattresses. In Albany, Georgia, a small deep south town where the atmosphere of slavery still lingered, mass demonstrations took place in the winter of 1961 and again in 1962. Of 22,000 black people in Albany, over 1,000 went to jail for marching, assembling, to protest segregation and discrimination. Here, as in all the demonstrations that would sweep over the South, little black children participated. A new generation was learning to act. The Albany police chief, after one of the mass arrests, was taking the names of prisoners lined up before his desk. He looked up and saw a Negro boy, about 9 years old. "What's your name?" The boy looked straight at him and said, "Freedom, freedom." There is no way of measuring the effect of that Southern movement on the sensibilities of a whole generation of young black people, or of tracing the process by which some of them became activists and leaders. In Lee County, Georgia, after the events of 1961-1962, a black teenager named James Crawford joined SNCC and began taking black people to the county courthouse to vote. One day, bringing a woman there, he was approached by the deputy registrar. Another SNCC worker took notes on the conversation. "Registrar, what do you want?" "Crawford, I brought this lady down to register." Registrar, after giving the woman a card to fill out and sending her outside in the hall. "Why did you bring this lady down here?" "Crawford, because she wants to be a first-class citizen like y'all." "Registrar, who are you to bring people down to register?" "Crawford, it's my job." "Registrar, suppose you get 2 bullets in your head right now?" "Crawford, I gotta die anyhow." "Registrar, if I don't do it, I can get somebody else to do it." No reply. "Registrar, are you scared?" "Crawford, no." "Registrar, suppose somebody came in that door and shoot you in the back of the head right now, what would you do?" "Crawford, I couldn't do nothing. If they shoot me in the back of the head, there are people coming from all over the world." "Registrar, what people?" "Crawford, the people I work for."